is the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Opposition to same-sex marriage, is it just cussedness? That's what former Missouri Senator John Danforth says. And in a speech he gave to the Log Cabin Republicans on Saturday night, that's a group of homosexual activists within the Republican Party, he suggested that attempts to modify and to amend the U.S. Constitution to prevent same-sex marriage were, as he said, silly. Now, he was pandering to the group there. There's just no doubt about that. Because what he basically ended up saying was that any attempt to regulate human behavior by law is just wrongheaded. But, of course, try to think of a law that doesn't regulate human behavior. The big question is which behaviors should be regulated and which institutions should be protected and defined in law, if necessary, in the Constitution. I think Senator Danforth, who has a new book coming out on faith and government, has his point to make, and what he's suggesting is that he doesn't want those who want to protect marriage as defined in Scripture to have the say in terms of what our government decides that marriage is. Senator Danforth is himself an Episcopalian priest, an Episcopal priest who also has served in the United States Senate. We're going to be talking about his argument, and I want to start a conversation here about whether or not this is really the kind of line that Christians ought to draw, or whether we ought to take Senator Danforth's advice and just consider the idea of protecting marriage as a heterosexual union to be silly. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Get ready for your calls. First, a review of some issues in the news. There have been three major intellectuals who have died just in the last few days. And this is kind of an unusual collection of deaths, all of them of persons advanced in years. Jane Jacobs died at age 89 last week. Jane Jacobs died after having written a very famous book entitled The Life and Death of American Cities. She is one of those persons who back earlier in the 1970s began to notice that a lot of the ideas about city planning just didn't have anything to do with the way that people actually live. She was an opponent of many of the ideas of big government and social planning. She was against all these giant Stalinist housing projects and all the rest, and she was a lady who was ahead of her time. Only lately have governments decided that these really were bad ideas. In Chicago, Cabrini-Green and other major city tenements and housing projects for the underprivileged, they didn't end up solving problems so much as they created problems. And they just ask persons and indeed force persons to live in ways that human beings just don't naturally live. It's a reminder to us that God meant for us to be in community and meant for us to be meaningfully related to the neighbors around us. When you start putting people into concrete boxes and separating them by great multi-level interstates, bad things happen because there is no accountability of persons. There is no accountability to a neighborhood, to the idea that we are in a community together. Jane Jacobs died last week at age 89. And it's another point of reminder for us of how America has gone down many roads of really, really bad ideas. And I'm thankful that Jane Jacobs saw through some of those. On the other hand, John Kenneth Galbraith died last week. Now, there is another name that has been in the news for a long time, and Professor Galbraith, who taught at Harvard for over half a century, was 97 years old. He was one of the architects of big government. He was one of the economists who really pressed the idea that that more central planning and central federal control of the government should be the goal of our economic system. And as a matter of fact, he was the great antagonist in the debate that he had for most of his lifetime with William F. Buckley. And as a matter of fact, if you ever had the opportunity to see them spar together, you know that here you had two men who respected each other, but represented something like polar opposites on the political spectrum, with John Kenneth Galbraith far on the left and William F. Buckley on the right. And they had very interesting debates, sometimes on Buckley's television show, The Firing Line. Now, again, John Kenneth Galbraith is one of those whose ideas were shown to come up short of reality. Even as recently as the 1980s, Galbraith was suggesting that the economy of the Soviet Union was actually healthier than the economy of the capitalist West, and the United States in particular. Embarrassingly enough for Professor Galbraith, that came shortly before the fall of the Soviet Union. But it is a reminder to us of the power of ideas, and sometimes bad ideas can go a long way in producing really, really bad effects. One of the men who understood that is another one who died just in recent days, Jean-Francois Revel, prolific philosopher, writer, and journalist in France. A man who stood for liberty and democracy and freedom, died after a sustained illness. His wife did not release the cause of his death, but he was at age 82. In a part of his life earlier on, immediately after World War II, Jean-Francois Revel was known as a leftist. As a matter of fact, he flirted with Marxism and communism, but later he began to understand that Marxism and its expression in communism were directly subversive of human dignity. And Jean-Francois Revel became a great patron of democracy and freedom. Jean-Francois Revel was also a prophet in his own time. He was very critical of the French government, critical of what he saw as a softness, a weakness within European society. Jean-Francois Revel was very, very concerned about the rising number of Islamic immigrants, Muslim immigrants into Europe, and the fact that Europe seemed to have lost confidence in its own reason for being. Not only France, but all of us are impoverished with the death of Jean-Francois Revel. He wrote many, many seminal works, and I can remember years ago when I first read an English translation of one of Revel's classics on democracy, and I understood that here was a man who had seen democracy's enemies and understood that democracy was worth defending. Human dignity was on the line. Three very significant intellectuals dying just in the last few days. It's a reminder to us also of the fact that, like that Christian hymn expresses, time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all its sons away. Life is fleeting, and every single human life encompasses, even at its greatest length, something like, in the case of John Kenneth Galbraith, 97 years. In reality, that is a very short amount of time over against the spectrum of human history. But you can also be reminded in this of the power of ideas, of good and healthy ideas that align with the truth, that lead to human happiness and good, and deeply subversive ideas that can lead to great human misery and worse. Other issues in the news include all kinds of confusion all over the place. At the University of Colorado in Boulder, officials are looking into the possibility of transgendered bathrooms. They're looking for what they're calling, and I quote, all gendered bathrooms. Now, you know that you have entered some kind of postmodern fantasy land when you refer to bathrooms with the designation all genders. Well, how many genders are there? Well, see, that's the confusion of this postmodern age. If you believe that gender is simply a social construct, then there can be an almost infinite number of social constructs. You not only have male and female, you have once female, now male on the way to female on the way to male on the way to female, back to female, back to male. It just goes around and around and around. And so how do you deal with that confusion? You can't have that many different bathrooms. How would you know what plumbing to put in? You simply declare them all gendered bathrooms. And that's what may be coming at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And, folks, if you don't watch it, it may soon be coming to a bathroom near you. A lot of news out there about what's going on with psychotic drugs and teens, and some of this is really, really important. The Washington Post argues that even as there's a lot of attention to the deleterious side effects of some of these drug therapies, the real reason a lot of these drugs are used, now get this from the Washington Post, is because many parents, especially the parents of pre-adolescent and adolescent boys, simply don't want to take the time to solve the problem without drugs. The drugs appear to be a quick fix. Instead of spending time with the kids and doing the things that would lead to a healthier life both for the boys and for their families, a lot of parents are simply looking for an easy way out. And in our drug-fixed culture, one of the quickest ways out for a lot of persons is simply to pop a pill or give the kid a pill, give the kid a drug. Well, now there are a lot of concerns about what some of these drugs are doing in terms of side effects and all the rest and long-term use. But in reality, we need to be very, very careful whenever it is proposed that there is a pharmacological answer to a basic human problem. We are not a mass of chemicals. Just adding new chemicals is not going to solve the problem. And when you look at these psychotropic drugs and you look at the effects, well, even the secular newspapers now are suggesting they carry big risks for children. USA Today is reporting that a Food and Drug Administration report is suggesting that some of these drugs, Clozaril, Risperdal, Zyprexa, Seroquel, Abilify, and Geodon, that these for adults are somewhat dangerous, and these new antipsychotic drugs may come with some significant side effects, especially when related to children. Well, folks, just as if there isn't enough to talk about, You should see the advertisement full page in the New York Times. It shows several dogs in the debris of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and the big slogan in the ad is "No pet left behind." According to the ad, during Hurricane Katrina, thousands of pets were left stranded in the Gulf region because our responding agencies didn't have a plan. Many people stayed behind, putting themselves in danger because they wouldn't have left their best friends. Now, folks, I speak on behalf of myself, my entire family, and Baxter the Wonder Beagle. When there aren't enough ways to get humans out of a place of danger, it's not the time to talk about rescuing pets. Let's get the order straight here. No human left behind first. I'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. You know, these days, we're just hearing a lot of conversation about the limits of legislation and the purpose of law. And it's really coming up over issues of human behavior. But we're not really talking about issues of human behavior like embezzling or stealing or plagiarism or exceeding the speed limit. We're talking about sexual behavior. That's where there are a lot of people making the argument that we ought not to legislate or regulate in those areas. You know, the human freedom just basically means the freedom from all restraints on legal ramifications of sexual or relational issues. And, you know, there are just so many questions related to that. First of all, I just have to wonder what kind of society the people who are making that argument really want. The other thing that frustrates me is they are rarely honest about where they would draw the line. Because I can guarantee you there's almost no one on the planet who would actually say they want no laws and no regulations concerning human sexual behavior. I mean, the people who are now pressing for same-sex marriage say that they're not for polygamy, and they're trying to argue that polygamy is not the natural outgrowth of same-sex marriage. That's nonsense, of course. If you can change the gender of the marital union, you can certainly change the number. The number's less significant than the gender. But then there are other people. I mean, there's no one out there in marches in the streets of San Francisco and other cities for incest rights. But that's a sexual activity, and it can be consensual. And not just intergenerational. You could have brothers and sisters or cousins or whatever. And all I'm saying is that just about everyone has limits. Even when they say you can't legislate morality, what they mean is you can't legislate that issue. But everyone on the planet, in one way or another, even the most extreme anarchist, in his or her heart, actually wants to legislate some sexual behavior. The question is where you draw the line. And Western civilization has drawn the line very clearly at heterosexual marriage for thousands of years. Thousands of years. This isn't a recent development. This isn't something that some committee came up with in the Victorian era. This is the reality of what I, as a theologian, would have to point to as God's common grace. Virtually every civilization on the planet has come to the conclusion the heterosexual coupling, formalized in what we would call marriage, is the basic molecular structure of society. But now we're being told those old rules are off, and in this new day of sexual liberation, all the restraints are off, all the regulations are gone. And there are some persons who serve more or less as political, cultural, and intellectual enablers of that process. And one of those is former Senator John Danforth, often known as Jack Danforth. He was, until 1995, a Republican senator from the state of Missouri. He is the heir to the Ralston-Purina fortune. He was distinguished in the Senate for the fact that he was a border state senator who was known as a Republican of a moderate variety. He is also an Episcopal priest ordained to the priesthood. John Danforth was a familiar face in Washington for many years, and now he is interjecting himself back into the national discussion. He has a book coming out later this year that is going to focus on these issues. It is to be a book that is on faith and politics. It's coming out September the 12th. Its title is going to be Faith and Politics. But in an address he gave to the Log Cabin Republicans on Saturday night this past week, he really put his cards on the table, so to speak. Now, it's not as if we hadn't been warned. In the Washington Post and in the New York Times, he had attacked conservative Christians for efforts to protect marriage. In some of these articles earlier this year, he referred to such efforts as, quote, just cussedness. I mean, as if conservative Christians or Christians in general or persons concerned about marriage had just come up with this concern about marriage in order to irritate homosexuals. It's the world turned upside down. You have to wonder how anyone could even say such a thing, and then why the Washington Post and the New York Times would publish it. Well, I know why they published it. It's because they agree with it. But now to the Log Cabin Republicans, a group of homosexual activists within the Republican Party. Senator Danforth appeared at their big dinner on Saturday night, and this is what he had to say about the federal marriage amendment. He said, some historians should really look at all of the proposals that have been put forth throughout the history of our country for possible constitutional amendments. Maybe at some point in time there was one that was sillier than this one, but I don't know of one, end quote. Now, let's assume that he meant to be taken seriously. Let's give him his due. Let's assume that he meant to be taken seriously. Can a serious man actually talk about marriage in this way? Can a genuinely serious man talk about the question of marriage as something that's silly, a proposal to try to establish the integrity of marriage, to define marriage? Now, there can be an intelligent conversation about the best way to do this. There can be an intelligent conversation about the limits of law and legal regulation. There can be an intelligent conversation about how best to define and to understand marriage in these postmodern times and in this culture. But dismissing a serious proposal like this as silly when you're pandering to a group of activists is unconscionable. And where are the multiple levels of accountability here? First, the accountability to common sense. But then the accountability to his ordination vows. This is a man who is an ordained Episcopal priest. The Episcopal Church defines marriage as the union of a man and a woman. But none of this seems to come out in his public comments here. He said this, let me continue from his speech. He said, and once before the Constitution was amended to try to deal with matters of human behavior, that was prohibition. That was such a flop that it was repealed 13 years later. Well, you know, that's true. Prohibition was repealed. But did prohibition deal with anything as basic as human sexual behavior and the definition of marriage? I don't think so. But then he implies that the rest of the Constitution, that is the Constitution that remains, that was not repealed, that it doesn't deal with human behavior. And of course it does. Of course it does. He went on to say it is a concept which is contrary to basic Republican principles. By the way, that's the Republican Party he wishes still existed. As I understand, the basic concept of the Republican Party is to interpret the Constitution narrowly, not expansively, so that legislatures, and especially state legislatures, can work out over a period of time the social issues in our country, period. Okay, now this is the kind of nonsense, as Winston Churchill would say, up with which we cannot put. Number one, when you are amending the Constitution, you are not interpreting the Constitution. That is one of the most illogical and ridiculous assertions that Senator Danforth made. When you amend the Constitution, you're not interpreting the Constitution. You are saying what the Constitution is. You are writing the Constitution. Furthermore, the most ludicrous part of his proposal is when he says that we should leave it to legislatures and especially state legislatures to work out these contentious issues over a period of time. Well, that's what was happening on the abortion issue. And guess what happened to that? It ended up settled by the U.S. Supreme Court, not by state legislatures. Where was Senator Danforth to decry that? And what would he have us to do on the abortion issue? By the way, he identifies himself as pro-life. But let's get back to the homosexuality issue, the same-sex marriage issue, the marriage issue. Senator Danforth knows good and well that there is nothing keeping the federal courts from taking this up right now. There is nothing limiting the federal courts from redefining marriage after millennia of human experience. There is nothing preventing a federal court right now from taking the issue away from state legislatures. It is an amendment to the Constitution that is the only surefire way to make sure that does not happen. Folks, Senator Danforth says it's just cussedness involved in the effort to define marriage as a union of a man and a woman, and that it's just silly to consider amending the Constitution. Frankly, his argument has so many holes in it, I don't know where to pour the water. But it's time that we have this conversation. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Is it worth it for us to amend the Constitution to tell judges what marriage is before the judges decide to tell the rest of America what marriage is? I don't think there is a more important social issue facing this country. I don't think there's a more important definition in terms of our everyday lives than the definition of what marriage is. Once that is lost, something very essential to human dignity is lost. 877-893-8255. I'm Albert Mohler.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back. We're just looking at this statement from Senator John Danforth because it represents the kind of argument that we're encountering more and more out there in the public square. And there's more of it coming. You've got Kevin Phillips' book on theocracy, Madeleine Albright's new book just released today on God and foreign policy and freedom and all kinds of things. You got John Danforth with his book coming out. You got Jimmy Carter with his book making all similar arguments. I wonder what you think about this. Phone number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Samuel, listening on WFIA in Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Samuel.
Yeah, I just don't know how wise it is to put an issue like this in the hands of the federal government. Because if we do this, then what is stopping the federal government from years down deciding what constitutes a tax-exempt church and then enforcing that? And so I just don't know how wise it is to put this in Washington, D.C.
Okay, now let's look at that argument for a minute. Number one, the federal government has this power now. Whether they exercise it or not, they always could. But where would you put that power, Samuel, just out of curiosity?
I would put it in the state legislators.
Okay, now that sounds good. I'm with you there. I'm a federalist. That sounds good. But there's nothing to prevent any federal court from stepping in the next day and nullifying what a state legislature does.
We have historic precedents with the United States not allowing admission of Utah into the Union because of their polygamy. So there is state precedent for defining marriage, and so that could be used in a court appeal.
Okay, I'm not following you, though. What if you're opposed to same-sex marriage?
Well, then you say that we believe in the right of the states to determine marriage, and I think that the statistics show and the voting results show that I think most states would uphold it.
Okay, I don't know. I don't know how long that would work. But, again, there's nothing to keep the federal government from reversing that immediately. I mean, look at Roe v. Wade on the abortion issue. Isn't that the same thing?
Well, yeah, but there's people saying now, like Ramesh Panuru on National Review, saying that there's a good chance that Roe v. Wade could get overturned in the next 20 years.
Yeah, just think about that, though, Samuel. I appreciate your call, but that would be 50 years of abortions due to the federal courts, and the only way to reverse it is, unless there's a constitutional amendment, again, is to ask the court to reverse itself. The power is still in the court. You make a very interesting argument, and I appreciate the federalism in your argument. The best government is the local government. The states are better than the federal government dealing with these things. And, you know, it's easy for me to perhaps to say that. I'm in Kentucky. If you're in Massachusetts right now, you may be feeling a little bit otherwise. But that means you need to get busy in Massachusetts defining what marriage is the right way. Thanks for your call, Samuel. Very thoughtful call. Let's go to David calling from Little Rock, Arkansas, listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, David.
Hey, Dr. Mohler. I think we may be giving a little bit too much credence to the words of Danforth and some of these other folks, Carter and Albright. I mean, these folks are definitely has-beens and represent kind of a dying breed of politician. I think for the most part, the momentum is on our side. If you look at marriage amendments, for instance, the one that took place in my home state back in 2004 that passed overwhelmingly, I think there will be pressure that will be brought at the state level to amend constitutions and to put things into law. I think ultimately you are right in the sense that we will need some federal amendment to deal with this, but I see momentum shifting to us on this issue, because this is different than abortion. This is different than any other moral issue in a sense, because we're essentially, the pro-gay marriage folks are asking to redefine marriage, and I think that's where they lose the public at large. So I think a long term, we'll probably in the next few years we're in good shape on this, and I think we'll see a federal amendment be offered on this.
David, I hope you're right. I sincerely hope you're right. Let me tell you why I'm lacking some of your confidence. I am heartened, as you are, by what happens at the state level. In every single case, and this has come up at the state level, it has passed overwhelmingly. Even in a state like Oregon, where it was least likely to pass, it passed by a landslide. It's only 55-45 in terms of the vote. In states like Louisiana and Alabama, it's been by 80% and more. So that's good news. But here's the bad news. Go back to 2003, And remember, in this early summer, when the U.S. Supreme Court, in the case known as Lawrence v. Texas, struck down in all 50 states any law preventing sodomy. Just trumped the state legislatures, and even if it had been in a state constitution, it trumped the entire state authority to federalize the issue of homosexuality, make all sodomy legal in the stroke of one decision handed down from Washington. There is nothing to prevent this. Justice Antonin Scalia said in his dissent in the Lawrence v. Texas decision, there is nothing to keep this court from mandating same-sex marriage in all 50 states, given the logic of this decision. He said they just lacked the courage, in their own words, to do it then. The phone number 877-893-8255. This is the Albert Mohler Program. Well, the big question for us is why we are right now basically where we've been for years on the federal marriage amendment. There just is no forward momentum on it right now in the United States Senate. That's why a large group of Christian pastors and others released a statement just in recent weeks calling for this, because a theological and spiritual concern for the American people is tied to the issue of marriage. It's because marriage is not only a social institution, it's not only a sexual institution, it's a teaching institution. The very existence of marriage is a witness to an order within society. When that definition gets radically altered, and you really can't talk about any more radical alteration than changing the genders involved in marriage, then marriage begins to misteach. And that's one of the big problems. You know, it just gets right down to some of the controversies there in Lexington, Massachusetts, Estabrook Elementary School, where Robin Worthland, a young mother, was troubled when her 7-year-old son came home because the fairy tale they were read in school was King and King, about a prince who marries another prince instead of a princess. You know, there again, when marriage is confused, you misteach. And when you're misteaching 7-year-olds about who boys should marry and girls should marry, you're really misteaching something fundamental. Now, again, the Christian response to homosexuality is not to be hatred towards homosexuals, but it must be clarity towards the truth. Because the truth is itself redemptive. The truth is itself compassionate. It is not compassionate to lie to people, and it is not compassionate to lie to people about what marriage is. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. The occasion of our conversation is a speech given by Senator John Danforth, Jack Danforth as he is known to his friends, there to the log cabin Republicans. And the caller we had just a few minutes ago, David from Arkansas, said we're making probably too much of Senator John Danforth. He's a retired senator, after all. He's been retired since 1995. But the reason we're having this conversation is because the argument he's making is one that is increasingly heard out there. And one of the reasons it's heard is because, after all, just in recent weeks, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other major newspapers have run big stories on the kind of argument that Senator Danforth is giving. And the editorial writers in the newspapers come back with affirming editorials. Yes, this is the dangerous direction the country's going. Because the argument we're hearing right now is that the only people who want to define marriage are theocrats. Now, I find that to be an amazing argument, that the only people who want to define marriage are those who simply want to bring divine law down and regulate every aspect of human behavior. Now, I have not really met a theocrat. I've read about them. I've read the Old Testament. But I'm not a theocrat, and I don't know any. Not really. I do believe in the total reign of God, but I don't believe that God calls upon his people to legislate his law in every dimension of life in society. I don't believe that's true. We're not legalizing Christianity and criminalizing every other belief system. But when it comes to marriage, what kind of confusion do you have to engage in order to lose track of what marriage is as an objective institution? The phone number, 877-893-8255. We have time for maybe a call or two. That's at 877-893-TALK. I mentioned the teaching function of marriage. If we're going to have a serious conversation about marriage, and I would welcome that conversation, then let's talk about what marriage is and what marriage does. In society, marriage is a definition. It says this is how human beings in the most intimate of relationships relate to one another. It must happen in this way and not in other ways. Every society privileges certain ways of coming together. And if you look at just the evidence of common grace, it's that in virtually every society, human beings have learned how to come together within the coupling unit of marriage, formalized as a commitment, a monogamous and exclusive commitment. Why? Well, it's because people like George Gilder and others, Lionel Tiger, are absolutely right. One of the great and necessary achievements of civilization is to require men to take care of their own children. And the fact is, they'll take care of their own children when they believe that these are their own children. And there is a reciprocity here of exclusiveness and of monogamy and of integrity between the husband and the wife, and thus they take responsibility together for their own offspring. In most societies, the big problem is not getting mothers to take care of their children. It's in getting fathers to take care of their children. And just try to do that without marriage. Look at our divorce culture, and you can see where that's led. You know, what kind of society settles for having to send out law enforcement to get fathers even to pay a minimal financial contribution to the lives of their children? But that's us. Let's go to David calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Look on XM Satellite Radio. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that you were bringing up a point about where our society is in terms of marriage and that gay marriage would change that. But I have to say that as a Christian, I think that we as a church and as a nation are doing a bad job of having successful marriages. I mean, with 50% of the people who get married, getting divorced, I'd say that the church needs to worry about the marriages that are existing rather than the ones of homosexual couples who want to get together and share a lifelong relationship.
Well, I got to tell you, on the first part there, you called the right program. I can't imagine any program that gives greater attention to the breakdown of the marriage culture in the church than we do. I just have to wonder, David, why the either or? Help me to see why the doing of the one prevents the doing of the other.
I just think that it's hypocritical. I've been giving this a lot of thought and a lot of prayer, and I couldn't help but think that when the adulterous woman is brought before Jesus, that Jesus doesn't necessarily start by pointing out her sin. He points out the sin of everybody with a stone in his hand, and I think that we as a society need to worry about, and as a church, too, more importantly, we need to worry about the marriages that are already in existence. And once we become better about keeping those marriages together, then I think that we can sermonize about what gay couples can do. Because when we say to them that their idea of marriage is wrong, when we can't even keep the majority of our marriages together, I think we're being hypocritical.
Well, I don't know that it's hypocrisy, rightly defined there, David. I would say the other thing is just to remember that in John chapter 8, Jesus did say to the woman, go and sin no more. In other words, he didn't leave it at just the accusation of the hypocrisy of the others. But David, I just have to wonder here, how far would you expand that argument? I mean, if it's just marriage, well, what about other sexual relationships? In other words, you can't separate the marriage question from the total question of regulating human sexuality. And if you're not going to regulate marriage, and marriage can mean virtually anything people want it to mean, because that is inherent in this. If marriage doesn't mean the union of a man and a woman, then it can mean anything, and very quickly it will mean anything. You know, that's one of the reasons, David, by the way, I mentioned this story from the University of Colorado at Boulder at the beginning. You know, now it's all gendered bathrooms they're looking for, because just two or three options aren't enough. That doesn't cover it all. Nor will marriage, if it doesn't just mean the union of a man or a woman. It'll mean anything. I'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. You know, no one said it was going to be easy, and it's not. Just trying to think these things through from a Christian perspective isn't easy. And when it comes to the application of our Christian beliefs and convictions to public policy, there are always difficult questions. How much? How far? How little? How much? To what degree do we regulate and regulate and restrict morality? Every single human being wants to regulate morality. Every single human being wants to legislate morality, one way or another. It's just which morality? Is it just about finance? Is it just about speed limits? Is it just about medical malpractice? In other words, there are vast areas. Every dimension of human life comes with the possibility to regulate and legislate. And none of us really wants to live in a community where everything is legislated. We don't want to live in a totalitarian regime, but every society requires at least a minimal level of objective understanding and consensual agreement. We are in danger right now as a civilization because we are becoming a society that is lacking in agreement in some of the most basic questions about the meaning of life, about human dignity, and about a question as basic to human living as marriage. When we think about the Christian imperatives here, it's not just to go out and tell people how they must live. It is to love them as love of neighbor would require so that we would wish the best for them. Ultimately, we must wish that they would come to know the Lord Jesus Christ as Savior. Ultimately, we must come to hope for their regeneration, not just their moral reformation. But the fact is that every society is headed towards either greater solidarity or greater dissipation. And a study of human civilizations shows that they rise and they fall. Whether you're reading Gibbon or Spengler or whomever may be the author of the day, civilization is not a static entity. An honest assessment of our civilization is that we are in trouble. You look at Europe and they're losing confidence even in what it means to be European. You look at America and what it means to be an American is becoming more and more minimal all the time. We are divided into red states and blue states and some states maybe in between. But the litmus test of marriage is going to be really, really important. When the American people have the opportunity to have their say on marriage, they know what marriage is and they define it very clearly. But we're living in a system and in a time when the federal courts can threaten to usurp the ability of the American people to speak to this in any given moment. And we as Christians better understand what's at stake in the marriage question. It is not irrelevant to the gospel question. Now, no matter what happens, we've got to remain the church, the vessel of the gospel and witnesses to the gospel. But it's going to add one more level of great difficulty when people don't even know what it means to be male and female, and they don't even know what marriage is. We'll be back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. Get ready for your question. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.